I really believe now is the time to be looking at the development of North Slope gas in the form of an LNG project exported to Asia Pacific markets.
Looking for a new way to develop Alaska's gas. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what Obama's new military strategy means for Alaska.
I think for Alaskans, there's a lot of significance in the new focus or the pivot to Asia.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A meeting characterized as historic took place at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage today, bringing the top CEOs of ConocoPhillips, BP, Exxon, and Governor Parnell together for a first-ever meeting to discuss a new approach to building a gas line for getting North Slope gas to market. BP's head, Robert Dudley, was the first to leave the closed-door meeting and talk with reporters. Dudley said he was encouraged that economic conditions have changed in world markets. He says the potential to unlock Alaska's gas for shipping as LNG to Pacific Rim markets is real.
It's a very large project. It needs scale. It will be an enormous investment. There are many steps that have to be worked out, but one of the first ones is getting alignment among three companies and working with the state. And I'm very encouraged. And I think over the weeks and months ahead, I'm hopeful that we can lay out a set of specifics to help move that gas to market.
Dudley says moving the gas south to tidewater in Alaska is probably the most economical way to go. The governor said getting the three companies together is a strong signal to Alaskans that there is serious commitment to getting a gas project going.
What I'm attempting to achieve is that we already have alignment between TransCanada and Exxon. I'm working to bring alignment now between TransCanada, Exxon, and the other two companies, BP and ConocoPhillips. But to do that requires greater alignment between these three companies that actually own the gas, and that's what I was working to achieve there.
The governor was clear that he is still planning to develop the line within the framework of AGIA, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. But that is seen as problematic to some. Former Governor Tony Knowles was in attendance. He says he doesn't think much of AGIA.
You can't outsource the fundamental responsibility of Alaska's government to negotiate the development of our resources. And that's basically what I believe AGIA did. It outsourced it, and not only that, but it subsidized it. So that's, I think, not by anyone's announcement, but that's gone.
But Parnell says AGIA protects Alaskans' interests in ensuring there will be takeoff points for Alaskans to access gas and encourages future exploration. He says incentives, like the $500 million to TransCanada, also help advance the line.
There are royalty inducements already in AGIA for those who got their gas in the first open season. That give and take was already established by the legislature in law. The state's interests were protected. There were some inducements given to participate. That remains the law of the land, and that's what we're trying to get alignment with.
The governor stressed the idea of alignment between the companies. This may take considerable work. Gas from Point Thompson will be important to getting a gas line project developed, but although the state and Exxon have reached a resolution in principle in the litigation over developing the field, there is still not an agreement in place with BP, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips. Also, BP and ConocoPhillips had for a time pursued their own gas line project called Denali, but abandoned it last year from lack of commitments from producers for gas shipments.
I want to see TransCanada and Exxon, BP and Conoco in alignment moving forward. And I wanted to see measurable benchmarks that Alaskans can count on and that they can point to and say, this happens on X date, and that way we know that progress is being made on a gas line.
ConocoPhillips CEO Jim Malva said the meetings focused on commercializing North Slope gas and promoting new investment in oil development. Malva says the companies have committed to working hard through 2012 to move forward. He said LNG is the best alternative for Alaska's gas. He called North Slope gas a challenged resource.
not because it's not a good resource. It's a very good resource. It's just because of where it's located. There's a lot of investment and cost, and we just have to really work this very hard, because what we see is a strong, good Asia-Pacific market, and that's where the Alaska North Slope gas should go.
The governor was careful in his phrasing about where the line should end, saying only that it should be at Tidewater. He said he didn't want to demand a specific site be used, saying economics should drive it. ConocoPhillips has an LNG facility at Nikiski. There is also the terminal at Valdez and ports in South Central at Anchorage and Point McKenzie. One of those in attendance at the meeting was Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker. He says the event was a good beginning, not a policy meeting. He says the common message is that the state and the petroleum industry must be partners. He called the meeting a mending of fences.
There was nothing profoundly announced, but it was the fact that we do have a relationship reestablished with the state of Alaska at the highest levels, talking to these captains of industry in a very open, a very transparent, and really reestablishing a trust between the our major industry in the state and the highest levels of government.
Hawker says the meeting reflected a positive conversation about the export of North Slope gas to Pacific Rim markets. President Obama outlined today a new approach to America's military mission. It calls for a leaner, more mobile fighting force with fewer ground troops, but with investments in new technologies and a focus on Asia and the Pacific. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington about what this could mean for Alaska.
There are no numbers attached to the vision President Obama laid out Thursday. The actual budget won't come out until later this winter. That will give more insight into how Alaska's military bases and programs will fare. But the president did paint a picture of how America's global focus will shift away from Europe and towards Asia, which he calls a critical region. Security experts and congressional staffers say that has implications for Alaska, which sits at the top of the globe and is a gateway to the Pacific.
I think for Alaskans, there's a lot of significance in the new focus or the pivot to Asia.
Michael Breen is vice president of the progressive think tank, the Truman National Security Project.
Alaska, of course, is of tremendous strategic significance in the Pacific region, and that, as the president, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State have all said, and very rightly so, that's the focus of American national security going into the next few decades and probably the entire next century.
Breen says he's heartened to hear the president's plan doesn't call for a slash-and-burn approach. He says the strategy is driving the budget, not the other way around.
You shouldn't expect to see bases sort of hollowed out. It's also important to remember, though, that we're talking about cuts in relative terms and serious cuts, but we're still talking about, you know, a pretty robust amount of defense spending. I mean, current military spending exceeds, you know, the Reagan-era Cold War peak, I think, by something like 23%. It exceeds the Vietnam War peak by 33%. So we are spending a tremendous amount of money on defense, and rightly so, given our global responsibilities.
On the other side of the political aisle, James Carafano of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, disagrees that the strategy is calling the shots.
The armed forces is a four-legged stool. The Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Army, and basically what they're doing is they're sawing off two of the legs. They're going to take huge force structure cuts in the Army and the Marine Corps, and they're going to stand on the two legs that are left. So it's really just a statement that says, well, we're not just going to spread the cuts around between the four services, and most of the cuts are going to fall on the Army and the Marine Corps, and they're going to be mostly reductions in the number of people.
The president is calling for smaller conventional ground forces as the American presence scales down in Iraq and Afghanistan. He wants small teams of elite troops and special forces that can work with troops from other countries and technology like drones. However, the strategy laid out Thursday calls for having the ability to beef up quickly if conflicts make it necessary. While Carafano doesn't want to see troop numbers go down, he agrees that Alaska doesn't face a pinch.
Alaska's probably not going to feel the impact of this. You know, they say this strategy is a shift to the Pacific, which is really, really not true. What we're really doing is we're cutting everywhere else, and we're going to cut less in the Pacific.
Some congressional staffers say the new military strategy will give the Alaska delegation ammo to argue in favor of stationing troops, jets, and training at Alaska's bases. Carafano says they can make that case and fight for the growing importance of the Arctic, but in this budget climate, it may not amount to much.
I wouldn't expect, honestly, big plus-ups. There's a lot of talk about the Arctic and the importance of building infrastructure to support operations in the Arctic. I think that's kind of mostly talk. So things may not get way better, but I wouldn't expect them in terms of defense to get way worse.
The new Pentagon strategy also calls for cutting costs by reducing the bill for health care for the military. How that will affect service members and their families, including Alaskans, will likely be a fight in Congress in the coming months. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, crafting the fuel offloading plan in Nome in the midst of a record cold snap.
And that's why we have provisions to have all of the equipment on warm standby so that we don't have things freezing up before we need them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency today reports that Alaska mining operations account for 90% of the toxic chemical releases in the four-state Pacific Northwest region. The 2010 toxic release inventory shows a national increase from 2009 of 16% nationwide. The national trend had been dropping before that. Regionally, all Northwest states had increases. Alaska's increased 20%, producing a total of 835 million pounds from 32 facilities in the state. Kathy Wen is the Toxic Release Inventory Unit Manager at the Seattle Regional Offices of the EPA. She says Alaska's toxic releases are the highest of any state in the nation, and there's no single explanation for why the numbers have increased.
Some of the reasons might be that there's increased production. The economy is getting better, so people are producing more. Certainly for the mining industry, there's variations in ore composition, which is one of the explanations for the increases there. There could be changes in production processes. And sometimes it's just a matter of facilities finding out better methods to calculate the amounts that they're releasing to the environment.
According to the report, the largest source of release is the Red Dog mine in the Northwest Arctic Borough near Kotzebue, with 777 million pounds of toxics annually going into the air, water, and land. Wen says her office deals with the total amount of materials released and does not go into questions of whether the toxic releases are within permit limits or are disposed of properly. She does not regulate individual sites like the Red Dog.
They talked about some changes in production, as well as for them, they were talking about changes in their ore composition, which was why their releases had increased. We haven't talked with each facility specifically to determine why they've increased from one year to another, but for Red Dog, that was kind of their basic explanation of why.
Red Dog's output includes 14 different toxic materials, including more than 800,000 pounds of arsenic, 300 million pounds of lead compounds, and 450 million pounds of zinc compounds. Other large facilities that release toxic chemicals include the Greens Creek mine in Juneau with 47 million pounds of materials and the Pogo mine near Fairbanks with 7 million pounds. The long battle over redistricting finally goes to trial next week in Fairbanks. The case involves proposed voter district maps that plaintiffs say are the result of politically motivated design or gerrymandering. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Two local men are suing the Alaska Redistricting Board over districts that violate state constitutional requirements for compactness and other standards. The board claims the districts were crafted to protect the Alaska Native vote as required by the Federal Voting Rights Act. Plaintiffs George Riley and Ron Dearborn live in areas of West Fairbanks, included in a massive voting district that encompasses communities all the way to the Bering Sea coast, a grouping they say disenfranchises them. Their attorney Mike Wallery says the court is tasked with assessing the legality of the voting district map crafted by the board.
With the board having the burden to prove that those configurations were in fact required by the Voting Rights Act. We, of course, disagree with that and believe that that was not the case.
Superior Court Judge Michael McConaughey has already ruled that one Fairbanks district, House District 2 in East Fairbanks, is unjustifiably non-compact. Four others, including the sprawling House District 38, are still at issue in a case that is expected to move on to the Alaska Supreme Court. The state is required to conduct a redistricting process every 10 years to reflect new census data. State Redistricting Board attorney Michael White says the latest plan uses urban voters to shore up less populous rural sectors of the state.
Unfortunately, this is the first time in the history of Alaska redistricting where that's had to happen. And that was caused by a number of factors, including the relatively slower growth rate in the rural areas and what's been commonly referred to as the out-migration, where now approximately 50% of Alaska Natives live in what by Alaska standards would be considered urban areas, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Matsu, Kenai, and Juneau.
White says Fairbanks is tapped to bump up low-population Alaska Native-dominated rural areas for several reasons. He says Fairbanks has enough voters to make up more than five full districts, and Democratic-leaning West Fairbanks is a good match for rural Alaska.
The fact that it had this chunk of voters who would increase or potentially increase the effectiveness of the district, given their partisan persuasion, and you know where Fairbanks is geographically located, essentially surrounded by rural Alaska. Fairbanks certainly is a rural hub for Native Alaska. The board took all those things into consideration when it made its decision to take those people.
White says the board plan justifiably veers from state constitutional requirements in order to comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act. The law applies to several states, including Alaska, where protection of minority voice is an issue. Plaintiff's attorney, Wallery, says there's no perfect solution, but that any redistricting plan should reflect certain goals.
Trying to keep communities of interest together, try and respect Native voting rights, try and respect municipal boundaries, and try and avoid some of the partisan gerrymandering that has so characterized Alaska.
Wallery says the state has never had a plan that was not struck down by the courts for gerrymandering. He says it's becoming increasingly difficult to use redistricting to protect the Alaska Native vote as rural residents migrate to cities where they are outnumbered by other groups. The redistricting trial starts January 9th. It's expected to run 2 weeks. The Supreme Court will take up appeals following a ruling in February. The redistricting board will be charged with coming up with a new plan to accommodate court rulings. A plan has to be in place 180 days prior to the August primary. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
Last month, two Kodiak Island sisters were taking photos of humpback whales near their home in Euganek Bay. Beth and Amy Pingree are part of a whale observation network, and they noticed something unusual. They weren't looking at a humpback. They sent pictures and detailed descriptions to Kate Wynn, who is a marine mammal specialist. Wynn identified it as an endangered North Pacific right whale. KMXT's Jennifer Canfield has more.
Just to be sure, Wynn sent the photos and details to colleagues in Seattle. They confirmed her identification. She says the sighting is very unusual for several reasons.
One is that there are so few right whales in existence as far as we know, probably certainly less than 100 and maybe fewer than 70 are thought to be living in the North Pacific at all. And that to have one in Kodiak waters is pretty unique. They have been seen on the east side of Kodiak, but this was the first time that one has been seen on the west side of Kodiak and in the bay. And it was by itself, foraging separate from the humpbacks, and probably just followed a school of prey.
Wynn says the whale looked pretty young, which is exciting. She says that a big concern with North Pacific right whales is not only that they are endangered, but that they live for a very long time. If the remaining right whales are so old that they no longer reproduce, then there is little hope for the species to recover.
There is some reproduction going on and some younger animals in there, so that was just encouraging to me.
So little is known about the North Pacific right whale that Wynn says they aren't even sure if that whale will stick around or move on.
In the North Pacific, it's much less clear what they're doing, if there's an east-west movement or north-south movement. There aren't that many, and we're not tracking them well enough to know.
Because the Pacific right whale is endangered and so little is known about them, Wynn encourages people to take lots of pictures and write down details if they think they've sighted one. That information should then be passed on to the FITC or a NOAA scientist.
Get a photograph of the back of the animal and the head of the animal, the blow, all those things are sort of diagnostic, and the more photos, the better.
Wynn says the creatures, which can grow to 60 feet long and live up to 100 years, were named right whales because commercial whalers in the 1800s considered them the right whale to hunt. They were often sighted close to shore, were known to be friendly, sometimes coming right up to the boats, and their corpses would float. All of this made them very easy prey, and they were hunted to near extinction. In Kodiak, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
The Renda is steaming north at 11 knots with the icebreaker Healy close by. The vessels are set to reach the ice edge around noon tomorrow and break through 390 miles of ice. The fuel is now expected to make it to Nome on Monday. The delivery was delayed last night because the Renda had to return to Dutch Harbor to repair a faulty valve. About 10 miles north of port, State Marine pilot Captain Pete Garay reported a mechanical issue after observing the tanker moving slower than expected in rough weather. This afternoon, he checked in from the ship as it was underway again.
So all's good after our false start from Dutch. Tomorrow's a big day for two reasons. One, we'll be finally entering into the ice. I figure the ETA for the ice edge is probably around noon. And second, tomorrow is a holiday. It's a Russian Christmas.
The vessels are about 4 days out, but the oil spill prevention and contingency plans are still not approved. The DEC is hoping to issue its decision sometime today or tomorrow. John Catula is the manager of the Marine Vessels Section for the DEC. He says the agency will issue conditions that require Vitus Marine to have certain equipment and personnel in place. But he says the final decision by regulators and industry partners will be made on scene.
We will be meeting to assess everything before any transfers take place, so we have a go, no-go decision-making body in place so that we can make sure that everything is the way it should be before any transfers are allowed to start.
As the pieces come together, Nome is experiencing a record cold snap. The National Weather Service measured 40 below this morning, the coldest temperature in Nome since January of 1999. Forecasts for the delivery date call for temperatures as low as 30 below. Catula says that's factored into the plan.
There's always concerns when you're dealing with those kinds of extreme cold weather, and that's why we have provisions to have all of the equipment on warm standby so that we don't have things freezing up before we need them. We've got provisions in certain aspects of the plan to deal with equipment that's out there that might have to be shut down for a while to ensure that we don't have freeze-ups and things of that nature.
The Coast Guard has begun daily C-130 flights to photograph the vessels and assist with determining ice conditions near Nome. Plans call for C-130 support during the fueling, plus staging a helicopter on shore. The Coast Guard will have Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the commander of the Coast Guard, in Alaska, on scene for a few hours. Last week, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano waived the Jones Act for the Russian tanker Renda so it could transport gasoline from Unalaska to icebound Nome. Among other things, the Jones Act says foreign-flagged vessels can't transport cargo between U.S. ports. Napolitano got around it by declaring the delivery a matter of national security. But yesterday, KUCB reporter Stephanie Joyce discovered another provision of the Jones Act, one that says foreign-flagged vessels can't transport passengers between U.S. ports. She has the story.
Alaska Marine pilot Pete Garay brought up the idea of having me ride the Renda to Nome as the ship was docking to take on fuel.
I think you should come. Just come along. If that's okay, I think we should talk about this.
To my surprise, Mikhail Shestakov, the representative for Vitus Marine, who contracted the ship, agreed.
I think Captain has a spare room. Am I? Seriously?
But when the captain said yes, my journalistic skepticism kicked in. Surely I couldn't just jump aboard a Russian tanker and sail to the Arctic. I ran through a mental list of potential snafus. But the reason that didn't occur to me, and that ultimately got me kicked off the ship in the wee hours of the morning before its departure, was the Jones Act. It's a huge piece of legislation that covers everything from vessel documentation to labor rights. But obviously, I was most interested in why the passenger part was enacted. Here's maritime lawyer Joe Stacey.
It was meant to be a pro-American industry and pro-American labor law.
He went on to say that when the law passed in 1920, Congress was trying to protect stateside shipbuilding and labor by requiring vessels operating in U.S. waters be built, flagged, and crewed by Americans. And many say it still does that. Ed Welch is legislative director for the Passenger Vessel Association, a trade group representing mostly U.S.-flagged vessels.
It ensures that our shipyards are building our ferries, our small cruise ships, our excursion boats. I mean, our people are doing that.
Welch added that it makes sure vessels operating in U.S. waters comply with U.S. laws, including safety and wage laws. That's true for vessels subject to the Jones Act, but it turns out that a lot of ships go to some pretty extreme lengths to avoid the Jones Act altogether. Take, for example, all of the big cruise ships that visit Alaska. None of them are built or flagged in the U.S., and they aren't crewed by Americans. So how do they get around the Jones Act? Well, one way is by leaving from a foreign port. If you've ever wondered why most Alaskan cruises start in Vancouver, now you know. By leaving from a foreign port, the cruise lines aren't held to the Jones Act, and they can drop off passengers in U.S. ports without breaking the law. It seemed like I was going to be able to skirt the Jones Act, too, until the last minute. But Customs and Border Protection caught my name on the passenger manifest for the Renda. CPB officer Kelly Lind says it's pretty rare for him to have to drag out the passenger provision, since it's mostly cargo ships that pass through in Alaska. But he added that he doesn't make exceptions.
If I would have allowed you to board the vessel and go to Nome, then, like I said, the next time a captain or something asks if his girlfriend can do the same thing, I say no. And even though they wouldn't know that I probably allowed you to do what they were asking, I would know that, well, I allowed one person to do this. How can I turn around and tell this guy that no?
I talked to one expert who told me the Jones Act shouldn't really apply to non-paying passengers. But no matter, I'm already off the Renda, forced, like everyone else, to watch the historic story play out from dry land. Still in on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, Ben Matheson in Nome, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.